Welcome to this week's episode of the CPG View, the number one CPG information source for global omnichannel leaders. Welcome to this week's episode of the CPG View. So happy to have you on. You know, we've been trying to get you on here for the last few months now. I'm glad our schedules finally allow this to occur. You know, we're on a mission with the CPG View to be the number one information source for global omnichannel leaders. And I think you're a great leader to help us fit the bill as we get started here. Before we do, would you mind introducing yourself and the company you're with?
Sounds good. Yeah, my name is Waleed Benshama. I work for the Coca-Cola company, and I am leading the Global Shopper and Channel Insights as part of our Global Human Insights team. I've been with the company for a little bit over 10 years, started in various roles, worked in various geographies, Africa, Middle East, North America, and now most lately in this global role. And half of my career was actually in marketing, leading brand strategy, and the second half was in insights-related roles.
That's great.
So excited to be here.
And we both live in the Atlanta area, so that works, yeah. Well, great. So I wanted to ask you, you know, the CPG industry is in the midst of transformation across the board, whether it be insights, whether it be retail media, whether it be the way that organizations are constructing their teams and strategies. So you're at really probably the center of a good deal of this, and would love your perspective on, you know, you're currently, to your point, in a global shopper and channel insights role, and you're at the intersection of consumer behavior and retail strategy, as I would see it. Could you share an example of where your insights have led to maybe some shifts in strategy along your journey over the years?
I'm going to give you the example of a global work stream that I've led in the past 2 years. And it really started when, after COVID, the retail landscape the commerce landscape have changed drastically. Channels have become more interconnected, more, you know, stepping into each other's used to be siloed roles, but now, you know, you can literally navigate the commerce landscape with no dead ends. So it's really something that pushed us to relook at the way we look at our foundational shopper insights. So I've put together a global framework called the Unified Commerce Journey. And through that, we really changed the way we mapped the shopper journeys, really end-to-end. And so even the consumer and shopper-facing dynamics were much more closer. And that double hat that each individual is wearing is actually, there's not a lot of lag time in between both behaviors as it used to be in the past. So through that framework, it really helped us define the right conversion pathways, both for recruitment and retention. And the reason is that these are often nuanced within the CPG business. You know, for most of the brands, they have existing consumer bases that they need to maintain and retain, but also the headroom for growth is still very big in our industry. And so by constructing these conversion pathways by category entry points or occasions, by platform of commerce, that helped us inform better the end-to-end activation architectures. So by building a stronger link between the consumer-facing and the shopper-facing engagement platforms, we ensured that we monetized that brand engagement in a much more effective way. It also helped us create portfolio synergies. You know, most of the CPG brands that have many brands that operate within the same industry, long gone the days where, I don't even know if there were such days where you could fund each brand to its maximum potential. So you really need to know when you bring the strength of your portfolio, and then you have a brand that can hero the messaging, that can hero the engagement, but behind you offer all that range of choice to your shoppers. And also that framework helped us identify the most effective touch points, you know, along those various conversion pathways. And how do you combine the touch points with the commerce platform to maximize that monetization? So even getting as granular as that helped us really be clear on how to put our efforts and where to put them in order to maximize our ROI.
That's interesting. And even with you, when you take a step back and everything you just said in conjunction with, we even think about think even about retail media, what's happened this year, round numbers, it'll be about $50 billion, and in the next 4 years it's going to be north of 100 billion, I think 120 or somewhere in that neighborhood. But to your point, I mean, really being prescriptive and having a framework. I agree with you, having had past experiences in similar types of roles, of really grounds you and your strategy and your choices, because not having that type of framework does lead to a bit of, I don't want to say chaos, but there's a lot of waste and inefficiency in the system that it sounds like you've been able to get in front of, leveraging the framework that you mentioned. That's great. Well, I wanted to ask you too, we think about, you've really had a very unique opportunity from both global and local brands across different continents. You mentioned earlier in our conversation, how do you think about adapting global CPG brands, whether it's a Fanta or Sprite, to local markets? And maybe in your journey, what challenges have you encountered along the way?
I think whether you are, at the market level or at the global level, I think the starting mindset is there are more commonalities than we like to believe. There are more commonalities between markets than differences. And so when you start with that mindset, that pushes you to approach the exercise in a more human-centric fashion. So the foundation is find that universal human truth. Find that universal human tension where your brand can bring a meaningful and differentiated solution. So that universal truth and that universal human tension, surely there is one that is quite common to all your, main countries that you operate in for that particular brand or category. And so from that moment, you ensure that at least the base of everything you do is of a strong tension to be solved or a human problem to be solved. Then when you come to the expression of it, that's where you need to allow the flexibility for the markets to define what are the local hooks of expression that will increase the potency of your global strategy, be it from a creative standpoint, be it from an innovation standpoint. Rarely a 100% rigid global initiative is going to hit the mark, in every single country. Wherever you go, you find that local nuance, you find that local expression that is a little bit tailored to the local markets, and that enables you to have as many hooks as possible to increase the effectiveness of what you do. But also having that skeleton that is consistent enables the brand to not feel like it's different if you go to a country or another. So it's really essential for global brands to have a global tone of voice, to have a global, I would say, essence that is recognizable wherever you go, but also allowing that flexibility helps you increase your effectiveness. In my career, I think I've encountered few examples where actually that rigidity didn't help some brands, evolve, let's say, especially the case of brands that were created out of one particular market where their brand vision and architecture was solely linked to that particular context. And so I remember working with the team, and there was a decision to start taking the brand globally, but there was very appetite to adjust a little bit the brand vision and architecture to be relevant. And so we encountered quickly barriers to actually bring that brand in that market and for it to find its own voice and be relevant. So I think that particular mindset of saying, hey, we're not gonna adulterate what the brand is about, what the essence of the brand is about, but if that BVA cannot travel effectively everywhere, then maybe it's worth taking a few steps back and relooking at it and adjusting it. And sometimes you do that also because, the context of where we live, change. You know, the world has changed recently versus 10 years, 15 years, 20 years ago. So some BVAs or some brands are lucky to have their BVAs being timeless, but even the most timeless brands had to adapt a little bit, had to adjust the way they show up. Some of their positioning had to be adjusted. So I think keeping that ear open to your environment and always check in whether your brand has that meaningful role, whether you're tackling a human truth or a human teaching that is still very relevant in our times. It's the recipe for any brand to continue being relevant across generations.
That's yeah, great. A lot there to unpack. Or I can also think about, in my career, I've been a part of teams where we've managed very recognizable global brands that have, 90%+, market share in a particular category. And I agree with you there. As I think about my journey as well, there's been instances where it did not really work as well as we would have liked, and it didn't as much go to plan. To your point, making sure that you have the framework in place and the general tone of, your BVA. So I'm just guessing, brand vision architecture, is that what BVA stands for in your world?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we could do a whole podcast on CPG corporate acronyms. It could be a bingo game we could send out for listeners to, guess the acronyms. We could go for days. But I agree with you. I think that's very helpful context with regards to companies. And depending on, many and that listen to this podcast are in global roles, some are in local roles, and many are in brand marketing types of roles, and really making sure you can take a step back and understand, to your point, your BVA, and you've got the right choices fundamentally made, but able to adapt and have some degree of, I don't want to say agility, but flexibility based on the local market that you're in. So I wanted to get your perspective on, as we think about innovation within the world that you and I live in CPG. And I know that you have certifications as, I believe, an innovation igniter, black belt, and a well-being champion. Did I get that correct? So how do you bring innovative thinking into the space that you're in and such a large company?
I'm going to give you an example of, what I think has become a really tough exercise to do in our industry lately, the marketing mix modeling, for instance. It's been a few years ago. It was typically an exercise that was done by, the biggest brands in your portfolio, those who have enough, means and efforts and investment out there. But when I looked at the portfolio and the number of brands that were being activated out there, what I've done is that I've brought a different angle to it and push what I call the portfolio mix modeling. So moving from that single brand view to a broader enterprise-wide approach to inform the portfolio strategic growth, like making sure that does it make sense to invest in every brand the same way we invest in the big brands or the medium brands or the small brands? Are there any opportunities to right size some investment because our ROI is not effective yet? So there is a threshold that we're going over that could be rerouted towards other brands. And really what was missing is A, taking the business to the aerial view, but also making sure that we bring that science into the investment strategy and the resources allocation to drive a consistent and balanced growth. So what we managed to do with that approach is to really have a clear investment strategy that prioritizes first the portfolio health and sustainable growth over looking at that exercise through the silos of every brand. So the very different type of conversation you have with the stakeholders, and eventually the most receptive to it is the executive leadership team, because really they have that responsibility across the P&L of the company. And then once you are very clear on Where do you go from there? Which one needs to have investment versus those who first need to fix, for example, their commercial foundations or fundamentals versus the brands that are yet too small to be able to give back in terms of ROI? And what are the brands that could actually benefit from one hero in everything because there is a halo effect on the rest of the brand? So all of that helped us also have a clear activation clusters where we mapped every brand with levels of investment that make sense versus two major criteria: the reactiveness of the investment, but also the ROI that you can get from that investment that you can reinvest elsewhere in the organization. So I added that step into the usual process before we even got to brand specific conversations and really looking at the optimizations from within. So that was really, I don't know if we can call it a game changing, but it drove the right conversations prior to the brand specific conversations, where we typically in the past went straight from looking at the brief and going all the way to the brand level. Well, if you have more than one brand, you need to be able to first strategically look at your portfolio, take the strategic decisions before you go within, and then you start optimizing in order to drive that sustainable growth.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think, you know, in your current role at with the you know, organization you're currently at with the breadth of brands, is everything you just said extremely relevant. And I think no matter how large or how small, you know, a brand or group of brands or a company, an enterprise is, can take insights from what you just shared. So I appreciate you sharing that. Last question here, interested in your take on, you know, AI applications specifically within CPG. Would love to get your point of view on how should we be looking at AI applications in the insights field that, you know, you're in today, and the importance of using the right language, setting the right expectations from design to implementation.
I mean, try to avoid talking about AI these days. I feel like wherever you go, it's like the cost of entry to any conversation. But I think it's we need to have more of these conversations, but I will say that there are two things that I would love for our industry and probably any other applications within the CPG world. Is first, we're focused so much on the products, on the solutions. We're not spending enough time talking about the way we get to do solutions. And so there is that, you know, that shiny object syndrome where we get wooed by the product, but we haven't actually spent enough time making sure that the way we get to that product is the right one. And then the other aspect of it is that we keep saying AI will replace. So that's the driving narrative. AI will replace this, AI will replace that. Well, in the reality is AI will not replace anything. I mean, right now, if we are to be solely objective, artificial intelligence can barely replace anything with perfection. And so I would love for us out there to start talking about more AI can help us improve. AI can help facilitate. AI can help accelerate. And so when you do that, you automatically put more realistic objectives into what the particular machine learning solution can bring. But also you take enough time to do it right and not be in a constant place of dissatisfaction. If you expect the AI to replace anything and it's not doing it well, then we're constantly, you know, we may actually take the wrong decisions. We may apply it to the wrong areas of our business. And so what we're trying to do at the moment is have a human-centric design to any AI solution, at least in our field in insights, with maximum awareness of when we introduce a bias, it has to be done purposefully. And if we don't want any bias, then we make sure that all perspectives are being captured into the design of that solution. Because again, we're humans, we're biased by nature. So if we want to leverage AI to broaden our spectrum of understanding, that we need it, that then that solution should be able to give us perspectives that we may not have been thinking of. Because again, we all come from different places, conditioned in various ways. And also, we'll talk about the art and science of prompting. So depending on how you ask the question, the AI is going to give you a different answer. But you need to also train the AI to know how to answer certain questions. So all in all, AI is made by humans, for humans. And so when you understand that, you know that you probably need to spend a lot of time in the earlier stages of the design, because then if you rush that stage, the outcome is probably going to make you lose even more time to try and reverse whatever bugs, if I have to use that word, that exist into that design. So in the insights field, where we're using it right now, in the short term at least, is anything that has to do with knowledge management. So how can you leverage artificial intelligence to help you archive, structure, and be able to give access to that information, to that knowledge capital that you've built over the years when stakeholders have questions to us? It can help us connect the dots faster. So imagine you have tons and tons and tons of research material. Artificial intelligence can actually help you distill based on your questions faster than what you would spend time on, right? It can help with our vendors speed the access to structured data. So when we field research out there, typically it will take, you know, a week or a couple of weeks for humans to actually take that data, clean it, structure it before we can start using it. Can AI help us speed that process? And then in the future, once you get those things right and you build confidence in the solutions and the belief in the within your system, then you start looking at things such as generative AI. But even generative AI needs human-centric input. So you think about marketing generative AI. If you want to build a solution out there that can, let's say, based on your brief, you want to generate a couple of execution materials. So in order to do that, the solution needs to know how to best structure a key visual, what is the right message that you need to put given the brief, given the occasion, given the category, and also how to design the overall thing so that from a behavioral standpoint, it increases the attention, it increases the impact of it. And that cannot be done if you don't input the right insights. So that's a way to give, I would say, a second life to the knowledge capital that you've increased over the years. And that's what we're doing right now. We're really going back and be like, okay, we've developed all that knowledge. How can we use it to feed into these solutions that would come into the future? So I would say this is at least the approach that we're taking, being realistic in our expectations in the short term and taking the quality time that we need to build the more complex long-term solutions.
Yeah, really fascinating. I'm a big fan of the topic. I'm not going to repeat the word, but I'm a big fan of it. I leverage it heavily, an early adopter. I agree with you. It's going to be great as we think about the path forward and how we can drive efficiencies and process optimization. And, you know, I'm sure there's bad with anything, but I could see so much more positive than negative. So, like, hey, I appreciate it. I know we spent time here together, and I just wanted to say thank you to you for joining us. You know, our mission is to educate, encourage, and empower high impact leaders on the CPG view. And having you on today, I think, puts us a step closer to that mission. So I wanted to say thank you to you for joining us today.
Well, it was a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the CPG View, the number one CPG information source for global omnichannel leaders. Mm-hmm.